Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello there, welcome back to the show. It's Justin Briley with Unbelievable, bringing you conversations that matter every week on Premier Christian Radio and all over the world via our podcast and video channel. And I'm very much still enjoying summer vibes here in the UK. We've had some delightful weather. And our summer of science continues on Unbelievable today. We'll be meeting Stephen C. Meyer and Brian Keating on today's programme. I'll also be waving au revoir to my colleague Ruth Jackson later on in the show, who's going on maternity leave, and catching you up as well on some fun stuff that's been on our social media recently. Still enjoying all the comments coming in since our Unbelievable conference a month ago as well. And you can get the digital download of that conference at unbelievable.live. For more from the show, including the show archive, our videos, newsletter, and ways to support us, do check out the show page too. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Today on the show, we're talking about the return of the God hypothesis. Stephen C. Meyer and Brian Keating join me. Stephen C. Meyer is Senior Fellow of the Discovery Institute and a noted thinker advocating intelligent design. He's been on the show several times in the past. His new book, The Return of the God Hypothesis, examines several key fields of science that he believes have reignited the case for a creator God. Well, in conversation with Steve today is Brian Keating. He's the Chancellor's Distinguished Professor of Physics at the University of California, San Diego, and host of the Into the Impossible podcast, and is himself an author of the book Losing the Nobel Prize. And today we'll be discussing some of these key areas of physics, such as Big Bang cosmology and fine-tuning, that Stephen engages in his own book, and whether they do provide evidence from which we can infer the existence of God. So welcome along to the show, Stephen and Brian. So great to have you both with me today. Let's begin with yourself, Brian, as someone who's new to the show. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your scientific career. I'd love to know what Losing the Nobel Prize is. It's a fascinating title to a book. Tell us all about that then.
Yes, thank you very much. It's great to be here. It's great to see Steve, who's become a newfound friend, and we've gotten to know each other really well. Justin, I followed you for a long time. So Losing the Nobel Prize is a how-to guide on how you too can lose a Nobel Prize should you get close to the opportunity. It's really an exploration of the biggest topics in science, written from the perspective as a memoir of a young experimental cosmologist. And it's meant to kind of be almost an antidote to some of the flowery, some say a little bit too suffused with the woo-woo-ness of borderline paraphysics, metaphysics that some of my theoretically inclined colleagues engage in from time to time. It's meant to be grounded in the excitement, in the majesty of really doing physics at the world's extremes. I tell the story of launching rockets into space, of taking telescopes to the borderlands of South America, to the high desert of the Atacama in Chile, to the South Pole, the very bottom of the planet, and what it's like to do astronomy, and connecting it to the through line that goes back to my hero, Galileo Galilei. And running through it is a different through line, which is the pursuit of perhaps understanding the biggest picture questions in cosmology and physics, maybe even in philosophy and theology, which uniquely amongst all the sciences is imprinted upon cosmology, you know, I never find that in my colleagues down the hall from me in the condensed matter physics, you know, experiments who are studying superconductors or studying, you know, biophysics. And, you know, for all I know, they're, you know, cutting open frogs. I don't know what they do over there. I think the dean should investigate, to be honest. But but they're not really wrestling with these deep questions of, you know, how did it all begin? And I wanted to do that from the perspective of an experimentalist, in contradistinction to my wonderful colleagues. Some of my best friends are theorists, but how do they approach it? And one of the leading guideposts is the person who starts off Steve's wonderful new book, Lawrence Krauss, who is a guest on my podcast, and his theory that really posits the universe came from nothing. For the first time in history, Justin, we can test that assumption using actual telescopes and data. It's a thrilling time to be an experimental cosmologist.
Wow. Well, it's a great podcast you run, Into the Impossible. I do recommend it. Loads of fascinating conversations on the frontier of physics and philosophy and that kind of thing. I'm looking forward to digging into what you make of Stephen's new book as well in the course of today's show. So thank you for joining us, Brian. Steve, welcome back to the show. Tell us a bit about this new book, because in some ways, it's the first time you're really tackling God, isn't it? Even though many people may think, well, you know, that's what Stephen's been talking about all along. But tell us about why you decided this book was the book you needed to write right now.
Well, right. You've kindly had me on before to talk about my previous books, Signature in the Cell and Darwin's Doubt, both of which made a case for intelligent design based upon the discovery of the information-bearing properties of the molecules at the foundation of life, the DNA, the RNA, and the whole complex information storage, transmission, and processing system that we've discovered in even the very simplest living cells. And I argued in the previous books that information in our experience, whether we're talking about the digital code in a computer program or a hieroglyphic inscription or a paragraph in a book, information embedded in a radio signal, is the distinctive hallmark of mind. It's something that we know from our uniform and repeated experience always arises from a mind of some kind, I argued in the previous books, but did not attempt to identify the designing intelligence responsible for that indicator or signature of intelligence at the foundation of life. In the wake of writing such a book, I had a number of people ask, well, who do you think the designing intelligence is? And what do you think that science can tell us about that question? And so I'd been wanting to write a book about that for a long time. I've been chewing on this for about 35 years. And in this new book, I broadened the scope of the inquiry to look not only at the evidence of design in biology, but also the evidence of design that we find in physics and what's you have had many guests on discussing the phenomena known as fine-tuning, the evidence that the basic physical parameters of the universe are against all odds and for no underlying physical theoretical reason, finely tuned to allow for the possibility of life, to allow for a life-conducive universe. And then in addition to that, looking at the evidence from Brian's field in observational astronomy, astrophysics, and cosmology, suggesting that the universe, as best we can tell, had a beginning. And then there's also some theoretical physics that reinforces that conclusion. So I became intrigued with the idea that when we look at that ensemble of evidence, the evidence of that we have for the beginning of the universe, the evidence that we have that from the beginning or soon thereafter, the physical parameters have been finely tuned to allow for the possibility of life, and then the evidence that we have that comes on far down the timeline for the presence and origin of information in our biosphere. I've argued that those three classes of evidence together support not just a designing intelligence of some unspecified kind, but rather a designing intelligence who must be both transcendent, in some way transcend the domains of matter, space, time, and energy, but also a designing intelligence who is active in the natural world long after the beginning of the universe itself. So not a deistic creator, not a space alien who could not explain the origin of the universe, but instead a designing intelligence who has the attributes that traditional theists, Jews and Christians and others have long ascribed to God, thus the return of the God hypothesis.
Yeah. Yes, well, you've summarized what is, you know, a pretty meaty book. In fact, I got the advanced copy here, and it's a meaty fellow, as you can see. But
it's embarrassingly meaty.
It's not quite
the
as
published version does not
in,
look
in
quite so
yeah.
The published well, version doesn't look quite so foreboding.
Justin, you should know I got the same copy in my office in early December, but it came with a note. It said, "Professor Keating, I would very kindly request you providing an endorsement for my new book, and I would really appreciate it if it could be obtained by next week." And I learned something from the late great countryman of yours, Freeman Dyson, who was a good friend of mine. When I asked him to endorse my book, Losing the Nobel Prize, he politely declined, saying, "I never endorse a book that I haven't read, and I've got a stack, you know, yay high, and so I'd have to decline." And I've always followed Freeman's dictum, and I explained that to Steve, and I said, at this rate, it'll take me a couple months, and he said, "That's okay." And I read the whole book, and I loved it, and I did indeed provide a blurb for Stephen's wonderful
book.
There
you go. You did. You provided an endorsement. Now, I was going to say... How's that gone down with your colleagues? Because let's accept it, Stephen and the Discovery Institute are not necessarily in, you know, flavor of the month for everyone. Putting it mildly,
do we have? Are you saying we have critics, Justin?
That's what
are
I'm
we
implying.
Radioactive? Yeah, toxic.
Yeah.
I mean, this, you know, and I was, you know, I listened to the podcast you did with Steve yourself, Brian, and you talk about this very, very openly at the beginning of that you've, there are plenty of friends of yours and colleagues who would, you know, regard askance this idea of talking to someone who does support intelligent design and so on. So where, have you come in for any heat for this, for doing even this kind of a show with Steve? What's been the reaction?
Yeah, well, I used to have tenure. Unfortunately, I have some news. I'm going to be seeking a position at the Discovery Institute.
You've not only lost the Nobel Prize, you've now lost tenure as well.
That's right. What's next? What do you have to lose? You know, once you have now I have true freedom, as Joni.
Freedom's just another word for .. Right. Yeah.
No, I haven't. I mean, there are people. There are, you know, internet trolls who will say things. I should say that my audience. You know, as I'm sure for both of you guys run phenomenal channels, you know, they're incredibly erudite. They're not afraid of challenging assumptions. And what is a scientist if he or she cannot accept criticism? And those of us who say science is fixed, science is not provisional, are not really acting in accordance with the scientific method. That's not to say that just because some authority says it, or just because Stephen is so brilliant, obtained his PhD from Cambridge, we should listen to everything he says, or because he's a New York Times bestselling author. No, not at all. And so my blurb is very carefully constructed and not at all edited. And you know, Stephen has the highest utmost integrity. And I wouldn't have done it any other way. And in fact, I said, and Steve and I had many conversations, as you know, my path to, you know, practicing faith, we can discuss another time. But I started off as a biologically born Jewish person. I am still a biologically born Jewish person. But along the way, I was an altar boy. I was an atheist. I was an agnostic. I was a practicing quantum Presbyterian. No, I wasn't that. But but I've had a relatively ecumenical upbringing. But I said one of my challenges that I have with eminent theologians and even erudite, physically erudite theologians like William Lane Craig, is that the supposition can be made from cosmological arguments to the acquisition of a faith directly in the salvation via Jesus Christ. And I cannot, as a practicing Jew, accept that. And I told Stephen that in all candor. And we had lovely long debates, and we will continue to have those debates. And I cherish those. And that is a sign of an open scientific mind. So to the extent that my colleagues would criticize it, I would ignore them, to be honest with you. And thankfully, they haven't. And I think they've encouraged me to have more conversations, even with other folks who are supportive of you know, design critiques. I would say, though, and I don't think Stephen supports this, young earth creationism, that's a different matter.
Sure. Well, obviously, and I do appreciate you coming on in spirit of openness to talk about this. I was going to ask Brian sort of if you would work to kind of put yourself on the faith spectrum where that is, and obviously you're a practicing Jew, and in that sense you're open to the basic hypothesis, I suppose, of God anyway in that sense. But I suppose what we'll come to
and
later
Justin,
is
one of the things that we clarify. Yes. Oh, sorry to interrupt. Yeah, Well, I was just going to say, one of the things that we clarified in our initial conversations between the two of us was just that the argument I'm making here is not a specific Christian apologetic. This is an argument for basic theism. And the considerations that would be relevant to evaluating the different theistic traditions, I think, come from other sorts of sources. You would have to evaluate what theologians call special revelation as well as general revelation, and then be differences in philosophical approaches to theology that would be part of that discussion as well. But I think the case for basic theism, my view is that it's very strong and it has there are both philosophical and scientific reasons to adopt a theistic position that are strong. And those are things that are held in common by Jews and Christians and non-religious theists as well. So of whom there are quite a number, actually. It's interesting. And some of the other endorsements I received from the book from very prominent scientists, it kind of surprised me that I think there is a greater openness to a theistic interpretation of modern science as opposed to the kind of really strident scientific materialism and scientific atheism that we inherited out of the late 19th century.
We'll get to some of the specifics in a moment. I noticed Lawrence Krauss hasn't endorsed the book, but you do nonetheless open the book with a story about Lawrence Krauss. Just tell that one quickly and sort of how it relates to, you know, what the book is about.
Oh, sure. I had a debate with Professor Krauss at the third, in fact, that I'd done, and it was at the University of Toronto in the spring of 2016. And I was unfortunate enough to get a migraine about halfway through my opening presentation, and it made it difficult to pull words for much of the rest of the debate. But near the end of the debate, it was under the heading of the topic at hand that night was "What's Behind It All," and the moderator asked, "Well, in, you know, summing up, what do you think is behind it all?" And I said, "Well, you know, I really had come here hoping to talk more about the identity of the designing intelligence. We didn't really get into that, but I explained that I'd been a theist for a long time, and I thought there were three key pieces of evidence that supported a theistic view from modern science, and they're the ones that I reprised for you just a few minutes ago, that the universe has a beginning, as best we can tell, that it's been fine-tuned from or soon after the beginning, and there have been big bursts of digital information into our biosphere since the beginning. And I got a lot of mail afterwards, emails from people who felt sorry for me for having gotten a migraine. Good news on that front is that I finally took the advice of my neurologist and started taking magnesium every day. And I haven't had a migraine but one in 5 years. So it's been fantastic change. So that was a silver lining. Another silver lining for me was that I got these emails from people who said, well, you know, of all the things that were said in the debate, the one thing that stuck with me was the thing you said at the very end about the three key evidences. And the one final silver lining for me, which actually led to my reading the book, was that reading Professor Krauss's book, Universe from Nothing, led me to get into the technical papers that were the basis of his proposal. This is a research program called quantum cosmology. And the research Dr. Krauss was popularizing the work of a quantum cosmologist or a physicist named Alexander Vilenkin, who had developed a model of the origin of the universe that was a slight variation off of something that Stephen Hawking and James Hartle had developed, also under the heading of quantum cosmology. And as I got into that subject, I realized that as much as this was being presented as something in support of scientific materialism, the basic worldview that Krauss espoused, he's a scientific new atheist. In fact, I thought, and I defend in the new book, the idea that the quantum cosmological approach actually has latent theistic implications. That is to say, the nothing from which everything comes is actually a mathematical actually mathematical in character. It's conceptual and mathematical. It's the laws of physics before there's any physics. So that's pure math. And those the what's called the universal wave function that they use to explain the origin of the universe is a consequence of a prior equation called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is an analog to the famous Schrödinger equation in ordinary quantum mechanics. And to solve that equation, the quantum cosmologists acknowledge that they have to constrain degrees of mathematical freedom. They have to establish boundary constraints on the solution, on the equation, to make it soluble. And that's another way of thinking about inputting information into the mathematical modeling. So to get a universe like ours, they have to get a particular universal wave function. That universal wave function is the product of an intentional choice of the modelers to solve a particular equation in a particular way. which is another way of thinking. What they're really doing is they're inputting information into the mathematical apparatus by which they model the origin of the universe. But where's that information coming from? Where are those constraints on mathematical possibilities coming from? From the minds of the theoretical physicists. So even if they could explain how you get a universe out of pure math, which is quite a trick, they can't explain where the information came from that allows them to explain the universe in the first place without tacit reference to intelligent design. So that got me thinking, there's sure. a new way to formulate this cosmological argument, not the way that, say, William Craig does with making the argument solely dependent on establishing a beginning, but rather by showing that whichever way you go, there are theistic implications.
That's really interesting. Brian, this is obviously your wheelhouse, as it were. So tell us what did you make then of what Steve had to say about cosmology, particularly Big Bang cosmology, and some of the ways that people like Krauss have tried to solve that in a way that doesn't require, if you like, a Big Banger, a cause. And again, you'll have to try and, for the sake of me more than anyone else, keep this fairly lay level, you know, analogies and whatnot are always good.
Sure. Yeah. Sorry for bumping in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, but we'll try to break it down later.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll keep it to 16 dimensions, Justin. I'll keep it. So, you know, what I've noticed lately with my colleagues is that they kind of cleave on one of two axes. They either reject completely the notion and find the notion of God so anathema they won't even treat it. They'll treat it as a three-letter word. You know, it's almost as if the you know, a four-letter word is almost too much encomia to provide to such a concept. So they'll treat God with so much disdain. On the other hand, there are those that will embrace it, such as Michio Kaku, who I've had on my show, and about which Stephen and I have much to say. Or in his new book, The God Equation, which ends with the very same words that Stephen Hawking's apocryphal book, A Brief History of Time, ends with, which is, once we obtain the final theory of everything, not guaranteed to exist, by the way, but once we do, presumably in string theory, his pet theory, then we shall know the mind of God. We hear from your countryman, the late great Paul Dirac, we heard that God is a mathematician of a very high order. We hear of the God particle, the God equation, the mind of God. I hear about it so much. These are God-saturated people. And even your very own Fred Hoyle, who I am 1 degree separated from, courtesy of the office that I have at the University of California, San Diego, once held by Jeffrey Burbage, who is Fred Hoyle's great colleague, and a giant Narlikar, who is Fred Hoyle's student, who I've interviewed on my podcast. These are steady state theorists who used to claim that cosmologists only adopted the Big Bang, Justin, if you can believe it, because they were overwhelmed by Genesis 1:1. So I came to become puzzled. Which is it? Are we atheists or are we theists? And if you read this literature, you come to the notion that we are deeply, deeply schizophrenic, or in other words, we can't make up our minds. And I think that belies sort of the incipient paradigm shift, that we can't really explain this fundamental chicken or egg problem of which came first, a universe or nothing. Which came first, atoms, matter, or a mind? Which came first, the information or the blueprint itself? And I think that's why Stephen's book is so vital. If it isn't correct, as I say, it forces you. It's inescapable. Like Einstein's equations themselves, they encode within it the way to do the mathematics that lead to the equations of curved space-time. Stephen's blueprint lays out a blueprint. You may not agree with it, but you have to confront the airtight logic, and you can replace it. Actually, I've confronted it because it is so engaging, and it's hard to think that a book, 579 pages, is a page turner, but it is. And in so doing, you must grapple with this fundamental question: which came first, the universe or the information? And I've spent a lot of time thinking about that, and the conversation continues because there are those that say, perhaps no, Stephen. And he knows this, the information is not all that finely tuned. And perhaps that is a valid objection, but these are open questions. And again, my job as an experimental cosmologist, it's been said that there are mysteries in life and there are puzzles in life. A puzzle is something like a Rubik's Cube. you know, I might not be able to solve it. You might be not be able to solve it, but Steve can solve it, you know, because he's super smart, right? So somebody can solve a puzzle, but a mystery, that might not be able to be solved. My job as an experimentalist is to turn as many mysteries in the universe as there are into puzzles.
Into puzzles. That's good.
That's what I want to do. And I want to do it with data, and I want to do it while I'm alive to do so. And so to have these blueprints, to have these burning questions, it's a fascinating time to be an experimental cosmologist because we can actually do it with data. And so that's what I'm looking for. Are there signatures, not in the cell, but in the cosmos, that we can look for, not to prove our theories, but to disprove alternative hypotheses? That's what makes my job so exciting.
I mean, do you feel, Steve, that the Hawkings and the Krauses and others who arguably have been more wedded to a sort of naturalistic approach to things, kind of they have their own sort of outcome which they're headed for, whatever the physics or the maths tells them, that they're always going to be looking for a conclusion that in a sense excludes God? I mean, is that arguable?
Well, I really am uncomfortable assigning motives to people with alternative points of view, because I think you have to settle, to the extent the issues are settleable, you have to settle by appeals to evidence and to reason. But there is a phenomenon in especially in theoretical physics, and some of the subjects that can't help but come up against these big questions, a phenomenon that is sometimes called the God-obsessed atheist, you know, the strident atheist who also can't stop thinking about these big questions and raising God-like types of concepts. Just pick up on one of the things that Brian said about this idea that, well, you know, there's some people that say maybe the fine-tuning isn't that finely tuned, maybe the information is not fundamental. One of the things that really inspired me to write the book was the realization, as I've studied both the biological evidence and the physical cosmological evidence, is that there's something kind of incorrigible about the role of information in the universe, or the role of fine-tuning. There are these now multiverse hypotheses that have been proposed to explain the fine-tuning. And I think it's the go-to atheistic explanation right now. There are physical reasons to consider the possibility of a multiverse, but I think the popularity of the multiverse is directly a consequence of its role in atheistic apologetics. And I think that's, in a way, speaks to your question. But what's interesting to me about the multiverse hypothesis is that for the multiverse hypothesis to work, you can't just say, well, there are all these other universes out there that are causally disconnected to our own. You have to show that the universes... otherwise, the things that happen in those other universes would have no effect on what's happening in our universe, including whatever process it was that set the fine-tuning parameters. So to in virtue of that problem, multiverse advocates have proposed various universe-generating mechanisms. And what's interesting about those universe-generating mechanisms is that even in theory, those mechanisms require prior unexplained fine-tuning to render plausible the idea that they could generate new universes. So even the multiverse doesn't really get you rid of the fine-tuning problem in the same way that the quantum cosmological proposal doesn't get rid of a deeper kind of fine-tuning or information, the information that's needed to produce a mathematical outcome that can function as an explanation for a universe like ours. So there's something incorrigible about the need for specificity and information, and every attempt to explain it requires either a mind or prior unexplained specificity and information, fine-tuning. And I think that's something I had a line in the book talking about Einstein and when he confronted the redshift evidence, and I said that the universe talked back to Einstein, because initially he didn't like that idea. But I think the universe is talking back to us when we attempt to push the information problem, push the fine-tuning problem out of view. It has a way of popping up elsewhere. It's an incorrigible aspect of reality, and it's one that in our uniform and repeated experience only minds explain. And therefore, I think that's a very powerful indicator of or a supporting idea, an idea in support of theism.
Okay, we're going to go to a quick break, and we will be back in just a moment's time. We're talking about the return of the God hypothesis and some of the key aspects of science that Stephen C. Meyer believes have reignited the case for a creator God. He's in conversation today with Brian Keating, who's Professor of Physics at the University of California, San Diego, and host of the Into the Impossible podcast. We'll be back in just a moment. ¶¶
listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
We're talking about the return of the God hypothesis on Unbelievable today. Stephen C. Meyer and Brian Keating join me. Make sure to check out the links with today's show to find out more about them. It's a fascinating sort of whole area. I love talking about this stuff. Often I can't always keep up because have you had any pushback, by the way, Steve, on the fact that you're not a physicist by background, but you're obviously tackling these big subjects in a book like this and critiquing, you know, some pretty significant physicists out there? I mean, do people say, who are you to write this kind of a book, Steve?
Well, actually, my first degree was in physics, but I did philosophy of science, and philosophers of science have this bad habit of butting their nose into all the questions that are left unanswered by all the other disciplines, or the really interesting questions, is the way I would put it, that are at the intersection between science and philosophy. And it doesn't take long to get a handle on the basic physics. The question is, what do you make of it? And that's where, you know, I hope to make a contribution. So.
Yeah.
And actually, on the question of pushback, no, okay, not really. I mean, I've had some wonderful endorsements from the likes of Professor Keating, who's with us today, your countryman, Brian Josephson, who's a Nobel laureate in physics from the University of Cambridge. And so I think the minds are opening. And I think the idea that there's an open and shut case for scientific atheism is kind of past its pull date. And I think people are beginning to open their minds to the possibility of intelligent design, and maybe even on a cosmological level.
Stephen has a unique distinction of having a Brian who won the Nobel Prize as an endorser and a Brian who wrote losing the Nobel Prize as an endorser. It's a very
He should have gotten it for his honesty, if nothing else. That's my opinion. But anyway.
I wondered if in this section of the show we could dig in a little bit to the Big Bang cosmology side, the fine-tuning side. We did a show recently actually on fine-tuning with Luke Barnes and Sabina Hossenfelder, which threw up some interesting questions which you both might want to comment on as well. But repeat again the different approaches that there have been to solving the question of how the universe came into being, Steve. And again, just elucidate again why you think they both actually potentially have these theistic implications. I'd love to hear Brian talk about that.
Well, there's a fascinating story that Brian knows well and that I tell in the book of just the progression of observational astronomy and astrophysics, cosmology in the 20th century, from first the assumption that the universe was eternal and self-existent to initial indications that the universe was expanding and expanding outward in a way that suggested if you wound the clock back, you would get to a point where you couldn't go any further, where there must have been a beginning. And then competing models that were proposed to try to explain the basic observation of an expanding universe, the steady state model proposed by Hoyle and Bondi and Gold, and then oscillating universe models in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. So I tell the story of the conclusion by the end of the century, but most astrophysicists and astronomers had accepted either the standard Big Bang model or what's now called inflationary cosmology, which also presupposes a beginning. And there were in the 1980s a number of books written by leading astrophysicists, for example, Robert Jastrow in his book God and the Astronomers, that were pointing out that if there really was a beginning to the material universe of matter, space, time, and energy, then that posed a grave difficulty for materialistic explanations for the origin of the universe. Because if it's matter that comes into existence, if matter and energy come into existence, then prior to that, there's no matter and energy there to do the causing. And when Stephen Hawking, along with Roger Penrose and George Ellis in the late 60s and early 70s, proved these singularity theorems on the basis of general relativity, that also gave additional weight to the idea that there was a beginning. But Hawking was very troubled by that. And both from a scientific standpoint, he would have preferred to have had a materialistic or physical explanation for the origin of the universe. And I think from a metaphysical standpoint, he was uncomfortable with the theistic implications. And so he devised, in 1983, the first what are called quantum cosmological models, and then published a very popular book about them titled A Brief History of Time in 1988. And I was fortunate to be a grad student in Cambridge at the time. I was actually able to attend some of the lectures that he gave that became the basis of that popular book. So I've been interested in this for a long time. And the quantum cosmological model is an attempt to explain the origin of the universe as a consequence of a quantum idea of gravity, not Einsteinian general relativity, but the idea that there might have been a different type of gravity operating in the very earliest moments of the universe after the Big Bang inside what's called Planck time. And the idea there is that just as in ordinary quantum physics, and okay, buckle up here just for a second, people listening, because I got to explain this, but it's hard to explain, so let me give it my best. But in ordinary quantum mechanics, just as the particle can be lots of different places before an observation is made, and we have a way of describing that mathematically with what's called a wave function, the quantum cosmologist said, well, we could apply that mathematics to the early universe and describe all the different possible universes that might emerge out of that cosmological singularity, where each different universe would have a different gravitational field and a different configuration of matter and a different spatial set of dimensions. And so the idea was that if that universal wave function describing all the possible universes that could exist also included a universe like ours, then we would have explained the origin of the universe as a consequence of this underlying quantum theory of gravity. The rub came in two ways, and this is why I think that even this new approach trying to circumvent the problem of the beginning has theistic implications. The rub was twofold. First, how does math, pure math, generate matter? And this was first acknowledged by Alexander Vilenkin. He said in the very last page of his book, Many Worlds in One, he says, before there was matter, space, time, and energy, what could these fundamental laws of physics, what tablet could they have been written on? In our experience, math is conceptual. It comes from a mind. And he then said, are we then really saying that there was a mind that predates the universe? Problem one, in philosophy of physics, this is called the reification of math, treating math as if it has the causal powers to produce actual matter, space, time, and energy. In our experience, math doesn't have that power. It's something we use to describe matter, space, time, and energy. It doesn't produce any of those entities. The second problem was that in order to get that universal wave function that might include a universe like ours, a prior big hairy equation, a functional differential equation called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, has to be solved. But there's an infinite number of possible solutions to that equation unless the physicists themselves fix very specific boundary constraints on the equation. Now, in ordinary physics, an equation like that would get information about the boundary constraints from the physical system being described. If it was, for example, a string fixed between two walls, you know, a string oscillator or something, the boundary constraints would be determined by the physical system you're going to describe. But before there's matter, space, time, and energy, before there's a universe, there's no physical system to give you information about how to fix those boundaries. So where do they come from? Well, it turns out that the physicists, the theoretical physicists, the quantum cosmologists chose those boundary constraints in order to get an outcome that they wanted, which was a universal wave function, which would include a universe like ours. In other words, it was a teleological end-directed mathematical modeling where there was an input of information into the mathematical apparatus in order to achieve an outcome. Now, that's nothing more than, that's just modeling the need for a mind to generate a universe like ours. It's a form of intelligent design. I think it lends plausibility to the idea that there needed to be a pre-existing mind. So even the quantum cosmological approach has theistic implications, which is odd, Brian, because it was proposed by very ardent scientific atheists, including Lawrence Krauss.
Interesting. Right. Brian, thoughts on all of that?
Yeah, so I have to push back with respect on Steve in that these theories of inflation were never posited to either provide a non-theistic or materialistic origin of the universe. They were posited, in effect, to explain certain features of the universe that were thought to be necessary, perhaps demanded to be conditioned for the existence of life, but not necessary to obviate or to eliminate the need of a creator the way that the quasi-steady state universe was. Although there were sort of philosophical categorical classes that they do share in common, whereas the anthropic principle and retorts to them, they were percolating around the same milieu in the 70s and 80s when particle cosmology came about. For example, I don't think anyone would say that the absence of magnetic monopoles, that would really be, a kind of a tick in the box for God. God. You know, God could really hang his hat on the absence of magnetic monopoles. And that was one of the prime motivations for Alan Guth, a young postdoc struggling to find a job. We can all relate to that in the late 1970s, dealing with inflation of a different kind back then, and obtaining this great position at MIT, where he remains to this day. And yet, it turned out that this solution that he found would later have to be solved by another colleague at Stanford University by the name of Andre Linde, operating under a completely different set of constraints in the former Soviet Union, to understand the properties of phase transitions. And it was found that in order to explain the properties that were wrong, that were known to be wrong with the initial inflationary universe. And this is something, Justin, I don't know if most of the lay people in the audience may appreciate. Typically what we in cosmology and most scientists do is we don't solve a problem. We just correct a whole host of problems that existed in a previous problem. And I always tell my graduate students when they come to me and they say, Brian, I solved this great problem. I say, Mazel tov, you just earned your ticket to an even harder problem, because you just picked the lowest fruit, you know, and now you got the next one up, because that's what we do. Newton was right. And he found the law of universal gravitation, and he paved the way for Einstein. Well, Einstein isn't the final word, and we now know about the properties of atoms. Well, Bohr was right. He won a Nobel Prize for this model of the atom that we know to be completely wrong, but it had certain properties that were correct. Those were updated and corrected by Schrodinger, Heisenberg, and the Born and the quantum revolution. So, too, with inflation. Now, the difference with inflation is that it might not be possible, even in principle, to prove it wrong, let alone to be proving it right, because of the fact that concomitant with inflation, because of the apparatus that's been built on to correct its lacuna, is this notion of the multiverse. It's almost impossible to find a model of inflation that predicts the beautiful patterns in the microwave background. So now we can play God, and I can bring in a universe, and we can look at the universe here as a deity would, and we can see these finely tuned structures, these fluctuations that would later become clusters.
For the benefit of those who are listening on the podcast or radio, you're holding a sort of 3D image of the background microwave radiation here. Just explain, yeah, what?
Yes, it's a beach
very
ball.
Very colorful and beautiful, right?
Yeah. Yes, it's a beach ball made by my friends at NASA, rendering the image of the tiny fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background that are far smaller than the fluctuations in this real beach ball compared to its size. These are at the part in 10 to the 4th. Fluctuations. They're smaller than the height of Mount Everest compared to the height of the Earth. These are incredibly tiny fluctuations. So just think, from space, you see pictures of the Earth. You can't see the height of Mount Everest compared to the smooth globular structure of the Earth. Anyway, those structures are consequences of inflation. But what inflation leaves out is, how did it itself get started? And that's where the multiverse comes in. And Stephen's exactly right. What Hawking and others tried to do is graft onto a theory of cosmic structure, a cosmological kinematic theory. They tried to graft on a theory of cosmogenesis, of cosmogony. And that is something it was never designed to do. And I feel that this is causing us a great deal of challenge in cosmology, not only because of theistic overtones, but because it's simply overextending what it's designed to do. And so it will never be able to provide an adequate answer to how did it itself get sparked? How did the spark that ignited the Big Bang, as I call inflation, how did that itself get ignited? That is a question that inflation itself can't answer. And the more that the Krauses and the Glindes try to explain it, I think it's it'll prove to be almost impossible to wriggle out of.
Justin, I'm real sympathetic to what Brian has just said. One point of clarification is that my critique of the Hawking, Krauss, Vilenkin approach is not that it's necessarily wrong, but that even if it's right, it has theistic implications. And I'm not claiming that inflation was generated as an anti-theistic argument. I think it was a very good theory to try to explain the flatness problem, the homogeneity issue. Inflation, but one of the interesting things about inflation, which Bohr, Guth, and Vilenkin showed with their famous theorem is that even if inflation is right, there's still a beginning, and you don't get around the beginning problem. And I think that's what Brian is just saying, that and with the beginning, there's the question of ultimate causation, which I don't think is solved within any materialistic framework. And quantum cosmology was super interesting to me because it presented itself as a framework by which you might be able to explain ultimate origins materialistically, but instead what it did was it explained it mathematically. And prior to that, in the mathematical apparatus, there was even the need for an intelligent input in the modeling. And so if true, then clearly I think this is, at best, I think you get a sort of Platonic idealism out of quantum cosmology, because you need conceptual realities to produce the matter. You need math to produce the matter. But if you have to also manipulate the math to get the outcome you want, then what you're really modeling is the need for intelligent design.
Now, I wonder, Steve, if we should talk a little bit about alternatives to inflation, which have certain virtues that inflation does not.
Yeah, that's your bailiwick, so you should go for it. Yeah, if our host agrees, we shouldn't take over his interview.
I'm all for the alternatives. Let's hear some alternatives then to inflation, yeah. Brian.
I would never presume to do that in another man's podcast. That is
fellow
most
podcaster,
rude.
Yeah.
So there are alternatives. Interestingly enough, they're both promoted by two of the original contributors to both the singularity issue of the Big Bang cosmology, along with Hawking, was Roger Penrose, a winner of the 2020 Nobel Prize, a good friend of mine and a frequent guest on my podcast, as well as Paul Steinhardt, who made some of the initial corrections to Alan Guth's original theory, and the inventor of many things, such as the theory of quasicrystals and many other. Both of these gentlemen, I claim, kind of are denying paternity to some of their earlier theories that they've once fathered and sired back in their youth. In the case of Steinhardt, he is now one of the most vocal, full-throated critics of inflation, calling it, in his words, not only dangerous to science, but dangerous to society, because it invalidates and eviscerates the centuries-old scientific method by basically, providing eviscerating the scientific method and saying we no longer need to subject our theories to scientific proof. And there's an article, I just interviewed Alan Lightman at MIT about his new book, Probable Impossibilities. And at the end of that book, he interviews André Linde and favorably compares him to Archimedes and many other explorers of ancient times in terms of grappling with infinities. And the notion is that the infinite universes that populate the multiverse from the mind of André Linde sprang are kind of tantamount to the grappling with infinity that Zeno and others have wrestled with since the time of Anaximander and the beginning of philosophy.
And Brian, is Steinhardt's objection there that they're inherently untestable? And also, and I don't know if he goes this far, but this is something I argue in the book, is that if you permit these infinite universe cosmologies, you also have this situation where anything can happen for any reason at all in some possible universe, and it ends up resulting in science-destroying consequences because you can't rely on the uniformity of nature, you can't make predictions, you can't make explanations, and you end up with Boltzmann brains. So I don't know if Steinhardt agrees with that, but that's one of the problems with those cosmologies.
Exactly, Steve. It destroys the testability. It destroys the meaning of the probabilistic measure that you can assign. It's not even clear what probability means in a multiverse. You know, what are the odds of an event happening? How do you define an ensemble? What is the notion of philosophy? Here's an issue, maybe, Justin, for another time to discuss with Stephen. But what would, if you have an infinite number of universes, and not only are the laws of nature have to be finely tuned in the parameters, the speed of light, the strength of gravity, but why not the laws of logic? Why not the laws of mathematics? Could they vary from universe to universe? Could modus tollens? Could modus ponens? Could all these laws vary from universe to universe? But that's not Paul's objection, a priori. His objection is simply that you can't make any predictions in a multiverse, and anything you get could be consistent with some other particular set of laws or set of laws of physics or laws of law. So that's his objection. Sir Roger Penrose has called the fine-tuning issue and the very low entropy state configuration that Stephen talks about in The Return of the God Hypothesis. He calls that fantasy, and he calls that, and again, he's one of the originators of the singular theorems with Stephen Hawking, the late, great Stephen Hawking. So these men, not only, though, the reason I want to point them out is they don't only assail with slings and arrows from the sidelines. they have constructed theories, rival theories to the inflationary universe, that not only solve the problems of cosmic structure formation depicted on this very very comely beach ball that I'm holding up here, very colorful, but they also provide a test, a crisp test, to falsify themselves. In other words, they have a mechanism by which they can be proven wrong, whereas we just established that the inflationary theory can not only not be proven right, it may not be able to be proven wrong, because not observing the inflationary signatures is not necessarily refutation of the multiverse or of the inflationary theory itself. So both Steinhardt and the Penrose theory have testable consequences, and they both happen to be related to the theory of cosmic microwave background polarization that is my team's specialty.
Yeah. I mean, just briefly, Steve, some commentary on those alternative theories and whether or not they have an anything to say to the God hypothesis itself.
Yeah, I certainly don't think they refute it. In Penrose's model, in fact, both of these models involve, they're cyclical models where you get multiple universes generating over time. And back in the 1980s, when the oscillating universe, which was a kind of precursor to these ways of thinking, was popular, Alan Guth showed that, you know, with whatever is causing the expansion of the universe, the process of expansion is generating disorder and entropy. If you think of blowing a lot of energy through a system, you're going to get a lot of disorder. So if you want to get another cycle out of that, you've got to find some way of resetting the entropy to a lower level, making things more orderly again so that you have more energy available to do work. And in both of these new models, this is still a problem. In the Penrose model, you have the universe expanding for a long time, and out of a very old universe, you get a new universe arising. And he posits a field which he calls the phantom field, that he alleges is capable of making that crossover from the dying embers of our universe to a new one. But it has almost godlike properties. And another one of his colleagues at Oxford, Julian Barber, has commented on this and said this type of field has no analog in any known physics, because it operates only in a particular time and in a particular space, and it has the ability to reset entropy, and it has the ability to initiate a dramatic change of state. In other words, it sounds more like a mind than a physical field. And so it's a really interesting proposal, and I'm really always open to evaluating and looking at new such proposals. And it may end up being testable, as Brian says. But the mechanism that he proposes at this point is more than speculative, and it has these properties that are contrary to our uniform and repeated experience of physics itself. We don't know of physical processes that can spontaneously, at just the right time and just the right place, reduce entropy, increase order, and generate whole new changes of state. And the Steinhardt model also has this same difficulty. He has the new universes arising at the beginning of after a big crunch, and he also requires an entropy setting resetting mechanism. And he acknowledges that it would involve novel interactions between the different physical fields. So that it's at this point, there's not a lot of specificity there, so I'm not sure it's yet testable, but it's at least an attempt to solve the problem.
Whether it's the kind of inflationary model or a kind of, you know, mathematical model or one of these other models, for you, none of them seem to be able to escape the need for some sort of information
And the Penrose, interestingly, the Penrose model has exactly the same character as these quantum cosmological models, in the sense that his phantom field is a purely mathematical entity that suddenly transforms into a physical entity without explanation. So you go from math to matter, and I think that's inconsistent with what we know physics does. Math is a conceptual reality. So it's interesting to me that the kind of mechanism that he ends up inventing to make that crossover has godlike properties. and it can reduce entropy. It's immaterial initially. It operates only at a particular time and in a particular place, and it can generate a change of state at that time and place, as a mind could do by making a choice. So to me, it's kind of interesting. I mean, it's certainly worth exploring, but it seems to me to kind of reinforce the need for a God hypothesis because of the causal profile he's painting of the necessary, the entity that he posits, which would be necessary to explain a new universe arising, has attributes that are more like agency than like matter.
Quick response, Brian, and then we'll go to a break and we'll try and fit in something on fine tuning as well. But yeah, go for it.
Yeah, I tend to agree with Steve. The only slight, you know, kind of tweak to it is I would say that they might not be philosophically or mathematically fully fleshed out, but they're currently falsifiable. In other words, we can currently or imminently, with tools like my colleagues and I are building on the high Atacama Desert at 17,000 feet above sea level, the Simons Observatory, funded by the Simons Foundation. If we observe the so-called twisting, curling pattern of microwave polarization that I describe in losing the Nobel Prize as B-mode polarization, that will be the death knell for Paul Steinhardt's model. And he candidly admits that that would invalidate and eviscerate his model. So although the underpinnings of it are not fully fleshed out, of course, you have to look at the sociology of science. It's a sociological field. Even if, you know, some argue that sociology is not a science, but there's still a sociology within science. And there's a tremendous amount of energy that goes into fields like string theory and inflation, and very little that goes into alternatives. Mm-hmm. So it's remarkable how much he has extracted from this incipient, you know, theory of him and very few others like Neil Turok and Anna Egis, but almost very few others have really picked up that mantle. And yet, we can perhaps prove it wrong within a few years with tech tools and technology that my colleagues are building currently and will be deploying.
That's fascinating. So, and bully for the experimentalists in this, that actually hold feet to the fire with some of these theories and say, do they work or not? Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. We're going to go to a quick break, folks, talking about The Return of the God Hypothesis, new book by Stephen C. Meyer. In conversation today with physicist Brian Keating. We'll be back in just a moment. Hello, it's Justin Briley. Welcome back to the third and final part of Unbelievable this week. And next week on the show, we'll be continuing our Summer of Science. This time it'll be intelligent design in biology under the microscope, as I'm joined by Dr. Günter Beckley. He's a German paleontologist who, even before he became a Christian, became convinced that the fossil record cannot be explained by Darwinian evolution. He's become a strong advocate for intelligent design in biology. He'll be in conversation with computational biologist Joshua Swammerdas, who's been on the show a few times now, and who advocates for reconciling evolution and creation. So look out for that on your podcast and on the video channel as well, same time next week. On The Profile later on tonight on Premier Christian Radio, Arianna Walker, the CEO of Mercy UK, tells Emma Fowle how miraculous financial provision has allowed them to run a residential home for vulnerable young women. And you can hear The Profile on its own Profile podcast as well. Just a shout out as well to a new show listener, Trent, who gets in touch to say, I found your Unbelievable program a few months ago and have been listening with interest. I'm a believer, but do have a lot of questions. I spent about 20 years in full-time ministry in Baptist churches in the US. Currently live in Michigan with my wife and have a computer business. Struggle with understanding, though, how God and the Holy Spirit are at work today. Seems like people's ideas in this area are very relative and based on their own experience. I've struggled with anxiety and OCD tendencies. This causes me to realize that many of my thoughts might sound good and I might think they're from God or the Spirit, but they're actually because of something I've learned from my OCD. I think it would be interesting to hear debates related to different views on the Holy Spirit. And the other topic you say you'd like us to explore, Trent, is the way Christians tend to say God did this or did that. And you say we lost a 20-year-old son to suicide in 2010. We didn't know he was struggling with depression. He kept it hidden from us and the US Navy. Obviously, we had a lot of questions about why this happened and where God was in it. And this has caused me to question whether we can really accurately say what God is up to. I still believe strongly that God exists and Jesus was God, but I think there's much that we can't understand about his ways and working in the world today. I wonder if Christians are uncomfortable with the mystery of how he works and try to convince themselves that they know more than they actually do. Anyway, thank you very much for that very honest account of your own questions, Trent, and appreciate you getting in touch with the show since you started listening. Now, you may find shows in our back catalogue on those issues that help you to put things together. The other show I could recommend to you, Trent, is the other podcast I present on a weekly basis now, the Ask N.T. Wright Anything podcast, where I sit down with well-known British theologian N.T. Wright. But he's very wise and pastorally minded as well, and we do cover these kinds of issues. Where is God in the midst of suffering? How do we understand that in terms of his sovereignty and so on? And equally, issues around the Holy Spirit as well. So I could recommend you to pick up that podcast as well, the Ask N.T. Wright Anything podcast, Trent. That's all we've time for in terms of your feedback this week. Going back to our discussion with Stephen C. Meyer and Brian Keating just shortly. But I will be also talking to Ruth Jackson before the end of today's show as we bid her farewell and au revoir as she goes on maternity leave. So all the very best to her. But let's get back into the final part of today's show.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Been such an interesting discussion today, the return of the God hypothesis. It covers a lot of ground scientifically, but we've specifically been focusing on Big Bang cosmology. And in this final section, I wanted to cover really the fine-tuning. My guests today are Stephen C. Meyer, the author of the book, and Brian Keating, who's the author of Losing the Nobel Prize. Go and check that out, but also his Into the Impossible podcast. I'll make sure there are links to both of them, but just for the record, it's briankeating.com if you want to find out more about Brian, and stephencmeyer.org for more on Steve. You know, again, we're going to have to keep this as simple as we can, folks, but I did want to touch on fine tuning. Now, let me give a really basic sort of definition maybe of what this is, the fine tuning of the cosmos for life. It's the idea that from its birth, the universe has been sort of comes at us with a set of specific numbers, certain law, physical constants, and certain specifications in the way that it's set up that appear to be perfectly attuned to allow life to develop, for chemistry to happen, for there to at least be the possibility of life in the universe. And on the face of it, there's no apparent reason why they should have taken these particular values, and the tiniest change in them would mean that life is not possible in the cosmos. And so this has generated a whole lot of interesting literature around why this might be and whether there are natural explanations for it. Multiverse theories, where this has come up a lot again in this regard. Maybe you could just sort of start from there, Steve. But maybe let me toss an immediate objection at you, which came up very recently in a show that I did with Sabine Hossenfelder, who's a physicist in Germany. And Sabina's whole problem with the idea of the fine tuning of the cosmos is that she says it's unquantifiable because we can't know whether or how much these numbers and constants for, you know, these physical quantities and so on could have differed from their actual value. So it's impossible to place a probability on them and therefore talk about them being likely or unlikely and so on. I'm probably not doing justice fully to Sabina's point, and you can go and watch the show for more on that. But what's your general response to that kind of an objection to the fine tuning?
Yeah. I know Sabine's objection. In fact, I've written a little piece about it at our Evolution News site. But maybe to put her objection in context, and I could explain it a bit more as well. Let me just explain a little bit more about the concept of fine tuning. As you explained very well, many physicists have discovered that there are many basic parameters of physics: the strength of, for example, gravitational force, the strength of electromagnetic force, the strength of the strong and weak nuclear forces, the masses of the elementary particles, the quarks, the up quark and the down quark, the cosmological constant, the outward pushing force that's responsible for the expansion of the universe, and many others, must fall within very fine tolerances or limits in order for life to exist in the universe. Against, as it happens, all odds, as best we can tell, because there is no underlying physical theory or principle of logic as to why these basic parameters have to have the values that they do, or the forces have to have the strengths that they do. In addition, I should also mention that the initial configuration of mass and energy at the beginning of the universe is exquisitely finely tuned to allow for the possibility of things like stable galaxies. And you don't even get basic chemistry without this fine tuning. So Sabine's objection is, well, yes, that seems to be right, but the range of possible values in which you could have a gravitational force is very wide, but we don't know that there isn't some underlying reason why gravitational force has exactly the value that it does. There might be some and she posits a multiverse, as many physicists do, as an explanation for the fine tuning. And as I mentioned, multiverses require universe generating mechanisms. So she says, well, maybe the universe generating mechanism is biased in such a way so that the gravitational force has to land within that narrow bandwidth. And so therefore, what it seems improbable against all the possible strengths that gravity might have, it's not actually improbable because there's something biasing the production of universes with that exact strength of gravitation, or any of the other parameters might be similarly biased. But when you think, and so that's the objection. It can't be quantified because whereas there's a lot of possibilities, we don't know that every possibility is equally probable. One might be more probable than another because of this underlying biasing in the universe generating mechanism. But my argument in response to that is that if there is such a biasing in the universe generating mechanism, then there must be fine tuning in the mechanism itself that is directing the outcome towards that propitious endpoint. You can't get specificity without prior specificity. You can't get fine tuning without prior fine tuning. And you actually find this in all the models in all the universe generating mechanisms that have been proposed. They all require prior fine tuning. And I explicate that in some detail in the book to make the point that even if the multiverse is true, is correct, that you haven't circumvented the fine-tuning problem. You've just pushed it out of view to one step back, and it still remains unexplained from a materialistic standpoint, whereas what we mean by fine-tuning, which is an ensemble of improbable parameters that exemplify a set of functional requirements, is in our experience always the product of mind, whether we're talking about French recipes or internal combustion engines or universes.
It's interesting you say that of Sabina, because on the show I had with her, she was very dismissive of multiverse theory, and it's one maybe to take up with her again. Maybe we could get you on with her in some, but she's not here to talk us through that. So we'll hand it over to Brian at this point.
Well, whether it's with a multiverse or some other mechanism, you can't get biasing towards an outcome without some prior setup of conditions. It's got to be directed some way towards that outcome, and then you would have the fine tuning in that set of whatever the universe generating mechanism is. And I read her to be implying a multiverse, but she does certainly refer to a universe generating mechanism. So that's got to be biased. Yeah. It's got to be fine tuned.
It may not be a multiverse she has in mind, but yes. Well, let's leave that for another time. But I mean, this is a well-worn area of the sort of intersection actually of science and faith in many ways, Brian, because the fine tuning does on the face of it look to be crying out for an explanation. Is it in your view valid to potentially posit God as the best hypothesis as an explanation?
Well, I did a video for a channel called Prager University about 3 years ago, and it was entitled, What's a Bigger Leap of Faith, God or the Multiverse? And it was funny. I got millions of views, and I have an update to that on my YouTube channel as well that your viewers can find, Dr. Brian Keating. And in it, I say, for centuries, people really would believe without proof very many things that you can't actually verify. And I kind of make the analogy towards, if you think about, all the criteria that go into making a choice of where you want to go for dinner, or, for me, it was, when I got married, my wife had a very, specific set of criteria and who she wanted to marry. I don't know how I passed this sieve, for me, it was like, will she say yes? Can she tolerate me, for more than a few minutes? But, overlaying all these different criteria, and typically the way we see things, presented in cosmologies, you know, like there's a two-dimensional plane and there are certain parameters, you know, the mass of the proton, the strength of gravity, this beach ball that the NASA team made that depicts the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background that I'm holding up if you can't see it, if you're listening to it on the radio or audio only. These fluctuations can be big, but they can't be too big. They can be small. They can't be too small or we wouldn't be here. Would there be too many fluctuations? There'd be overmassive black holes, et cetera, et cetera. So now the combination of all these things put together, layered on top of each other, is very interesting. That sieve becomes very, very finely grained indeed. And to me, the question of, you know, the joint probability of all these things occurring at once is simply a very, very, it may be a question outside of science. And when I ask that question, or the title of the video, "What's a Greater Leap of Faith, God of the Multiverse?" the scientists who reply, "Oh, science, scientists don't have faith." And then I reply, you know, with quotes from Andre Linde. And it really, I'll just put the quote there. And it says, "Why should there be universe?" And he says, in his own words, "Why not multiverse? You say universe, meaning one, that's more faith than saying multiverse." And famously with Martin Rees and Steven Weinberg, he was asked, on the scale of betting your life or your dog, you know, what would you bet? Martin Rees said, "I would bet my dog." Andre Linde said, "I'd bet my life." And, of course, Steven Weinberg said, "I'd bet Martin Rees's dog and Andre Linde's life." And so, you know, you don't bet your life.
And this is about the multiverse hypothesis.
Yes. Yeah. If the multiverse is true enough. So, of course, we have faith. And of course, faith enters into it. And to say that scientists are dispassionate walking Wikipedias, that we never have faith that enters into it. So in that sense, they're tantamount. They have very analogous behavior. Scientists certainly do have faith that enters into it. And it's been so since the time of Galileo and even long before that. Prejudice, confirmation bias, all sorts of things enter into it. And there might be this reaction formation that, you know, Freud says, you know, that is just so distasteful. And it's funny because the producers at Prager University, they don't know who Sabina is, but they have an extensive series of references on the, and a quiz on every one of their videos. And in that video, they chose one of her website posts that said, of course the multiverse is religion. and again, I didn't suggest it to them. They just found it. And I think, you know, she's intellectually honest enough to say that. I think the question is, there are researchers now. Fred Adams at University of Michigan has a 230-page archive post, and he's sponsored by the Templeton Foundation. So it's not some like rabid atheist. What is the degree of fine tuning necessary to have a universe like ours? It doesn't answer Steve's question. It answers within a universe that is existent, which is, you know, a big if. You know, it's like once you have the universe, you know, there's a famous joke, right? There's a scientist like Jennifer Doudna or somebody, you know, says to God, "God, I can make a man just like you. I can make a human being just like you. Oh, yeah, I can make him out of dirt just like you did. Oh, yeah." Yeah, she says to the creator, "Yeah, just here, give me some dirt." And God says, "No, get your own dirt." Yeah, so it's like it's the starting point. Yeah. It's, as physicists say,
yes,
the initial conditions problem is a serious, serious condition, a serious, serious vexing problem. And I think that is one of the greatest services Stephen does in this new book, Return of the God Hypothesis.
I mean, Stephen, come back to this then, because this is ultimately, you know, the question at the heart of it all is, can you infer a God from all of the data, if you like? Is that a valid thing? Now, I hear a lot of scientists who say you're it's no longer a scientific question at that point. You've moved into theology, you've moved maybe into philosophy, certainly into metaphysics, and they will just say that's, you know, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to make that leap to this particular kind of explanation. It's a science stopper is very often the phrase that's used.
Well, I think saying it's you're not allowed is an inquiry stopper, right? And I'm not really worried about those boundaries. I'm perfectly happy to admit that the God hypothesis is a metaphysical hypothesis, but it may be the best explanation of certain things we've discovered scientifically. There's a wonderful quote from Richard Dawkins, with whom I completely disagree on metaphysics, but I agree in this respect in the way he frames the issue, and he's brilliant at it. He says that the universe has exactly the properties we should expect if at bottom there is no purpose, no design, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Well, blind, pitiless indifference and no design or purpose is another way of saying materialism. And so he's arguing effectively that we can test the metaphysical hypothesis of materialism and other metaphysical hypotheses by looking at the world around us to see if what we observe matches what we would expect if a given metaphysical hypothesis is true. He thinks that what he sees is consistent with materialism, or is what you would expect on the basis of materialism. The burden of proof I take on in the book is not to prove God absolutely, but rather to show that the evidence that we have about the origin of the universe, the fine-tuning of the universe, and the origin of life, and the origin of, and the presence of information in living cells, are all things that we would not have expected on the basis of straightforward materialism. And you can see that, I think, very clearly in the writings of the scientific materialists themselves, who are now adopting these highly complex, somewhat convoluted explanations that might involve multiverses or imaginary time or space alien designers or phantom fields. I think there's a certain sense in which the atheists are now stretching in order to explain things that can be very much more simply explained by the simple proposition of a transcendent intelligence. And so the idea, you know, when I love this framing of one God or many universes. I've actually attended a conference under that heading. And if you, one of the arguments I make in the book about the multiverse is that in addition to multiverses require universe generating mechanisms that require prior unexplained fine tuning. But another problem is the incredible complexity of the multiverse hypothesis in the sense of Occam's razor. Because there are two different types of fine-tuning, initial condition fine-tuning and also the fine-tuning of the laws and constants of physics. And it turns out that to explain both types, you need two speculative cosmological models involving two different universe-generating mechanisms, one based on string theory, one based on inflationary cosmology. So not only does a multiverse advocate have to affirm the existence of all these innumerable undetectable universes, they also have to affirm all these pure theoretical postulates that are part of the theoretical substructure of these two different cosmologies. You have to believe in inflaton fields. You have to believe in finely tuned inflaton shutoff energies. You have to believe in all the extra dimensions of space that string theory implies. You have to believe in all you have to believe that strings are the fundamental units of matter. You have to believe in lines of flux that are wrapped around them, and on it goes. In the book, I list over, I think it's 10 separate pure theoretical postulates that are inherently unobservable. Nothing wrong with unobservables in science. We postulate them all the time to explain things we can see. But the number of postulates that must be affirmed with a multiverse proposition or proposal are innumerably greater than the single proposition of a transcendent intelligence, which is what comes with theism.
Brian, final thoughts as we start to close this out.
Well, I want to thank Steve very much for making me think and making me exercise the most precious supercomputer there is, which is the 3-pound wet work that sits on top of my shoulders. And Justin, I love your conversations. I think they're so fascinating. I could really talk to you guys all day and for a long time. And I always say, be careful when a cosmologist says, you know, just a few minutes, because, you know, we're comfortable with billions of years. And I really could talk to you guys for an eternity. It's so much fun. These are the ultimate issues in life. And I always say to my students that we're privileged to do these kinds of things and to get paid to do them. I would do them for free. Don't tell my boss, Gavin Newsom, here in California. He might take you up on it. But what we get to do, we shouldn't take lightly, because it's the most important thing. We are kind of carrying the flame, and we will always answer, and we will always ask these. That's what makes human beings unique. As Stephen knows, you know, Justin, I'm sure, Homo sapien means a thinking person, a thinking one who knows that they know. But, you know, science itself, the word science means knowledge. It doesn't mean wisdom. How can we convert more mysteries into puzzles? How can we convert more knowledge into wisdom? These are the things I think about. I want to thank you guys. I got to run.
It's great. It's great to have you on today. Thank you, Brian.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Steve.
Thank,
go ahead.
Thank you for being such a good interlocutor, and pressing on key issues where we might disagree, and thinking all this through. And Justin, thank you for your format, and you really let us both explicate some of these ideas in detail, and it's just a terrific format for discussing the big questions. So thank you.
Thank you, guys.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Steve, for joining me. Do make sure to check out Steve's book, The Return of the God Hypothesis, and links to both my guests, Brian Keating and Steve, with today's show. But for now, thank you very much, Brian and Steve, for joining me.
Thank you, guys.
If you'd like to get in touch about what you heard on the show, then do feel free to email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also send me your thoughts via our social media, @UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page for The Unbelievable Show. You can also find me over on Instagram, Justin.Briley, and TikTok as well, Justin.Briley there. It's been fun to see what you've been responding to on our social media recently. I was glad to actually be hosting an interview just this last week with Sohrab Amari for Hodder Faith. He's got a new book out called The Unbroken Thread, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos. Very interesting US writer, but originally from Iran. Hoping to set up an Unbelievable Show with Sohrab as well in the future. But you might want to go and check that out. You can find links to it from the Unbelievable Twitter account, the special broadcast on Facebook and YouTube that we did for that. The one that really made a splash, though, in the last few weeks was when I shared a press statement by atheists in Kenya. And this was widely shared around the internet anyway, in which you wouldn't have dreamt this one up. Press statement, resignation of atheist in Kenya secretary, Mr. Seth Mahinga. This evening, regretfully, the secretary of the Atheists in Kenya Society, Mr. Seth Mahinga, informed me that he has made the decision to resign from his position as secretary of the society. Seth's reason for resigning is that he has found Jesus Christ and is no longer interested in promoting atheism in Kenya. We wish Seth all the best in his newfound relationship with Jesus Christ. We thank him for having served the society with dedication over the last 1.5 years. The position of secretary of the society has been rendered vacant. We are calling upon Kenyan atheists who would wish to join our executive committee to send their CVs. It tickled me, and it tickled many others. It was widely shared when I shared that on the Unbelievable Facebook and Twitter account. And hey, God bless them, you know, the atheists in Kenya, for being so open-minded as to give people, you know, the full reason why their secretary resigned. Good on them, I say. Well, regular listeners to the show will know that I have a co-host and colleague who has just for the last year or so been an extraordinary addition to the Unbelievable team, Ruth Jackson. Ruth, welcome along to the show. But we're kind of saying hello and goodbye, aren't we?
We are.
Tell us why.
So in, how long is it now? Less than 2 weeks, I will hopefully be having a baby.
Woo. I don't know if babies sort of come on demand on the day that they're due, not in my experience, but in around 2 weeks. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it could be tomorrow or today for all I know, or it could be 4 weeks. Who knows?
I mean, this is the best of all reasons to be going away from the show for a while, going on maternity leave. So just huge congratulations in advance to you and Will. And God bless you guys. Are you allowed to share any more details about gender or anything like that with the world?
Yeah, I guess so. We're having a little girl, so not quite sure on names yet. And it feels like I probably shouldn't reveal that to the whole world before telling, you know, like my parents or something. But yeah, having a little girl. So very excited about that.
Well, we're going to miss you, obviously, but we'll be keeping in touch, and I will obviously let the audience know when the good news is is ready to be broadcast far and wide. But to say, I have just absolutely loved having you on board for the last, what is it, 10 months or so that you've been on board the good ship Unbelievable. Your insight, your experience, just the way you see things, it has been so helpful. And I'm not sure what I'm going to do without you, to be honest. but we look forward to you returning in some guise in the future. We're kind of hoping to really actually expand the apologetics work we do generally through Premier. And so when the time comes and you're ready to return, there will be a microphone and a video camera and a virtual desk if we're still all working from home awaiting you, because we'd love to do more, wouldn't we, with your your passion for youth apologetics and reaching young people.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, look, all the very best. Any highlights that, you know, being part of the Unbelievable team has brought you over the past year?
Oh, gosh, it's so tricky. There's been so many exciting things. I think having been an avid listener of Unbelievable and being sort of involved from a distance with my Premier Youth and Children's Work hat on, it's been so exciting to be a part of it as, you know, as a kind of full-time member of staff working on Unbelievable rather than just in my evenings and on my weekends doing it on the side. I think perhaps because it's just sort of in my mind because it happened most recently, but I loved the conference. It was so great. For a start, it was great to get out of the house and meet actual people in actual person, which was very exciting. But I think as well, the online element was amazing. Seeing people tuning in from all over the world, totally different time zones, and taking different bits from the conference. I had the pleasure of sort of trying to sift through people's questions and seeing where people were from and what parts of it they were engaging with was amazing. So, and obviously I loved hosting the session on young people, and it was very exciting to have Claire Williams and Sean McDowell and all of the contributors. Great day, loved it.
Well, I really enjoyed being able to co-host it with you, so thank you so much again for everything you brought to the show over the past year. But it's au revoir rather than goodbye. We will see you again. And really looking forward to all that brings, and with a new child in the picture as well, very excitingly.
Yeah, and I think you probably will hear my voice popping up here and here and there, because I have back recorded quite a lot of episodes of the C.S. Lewis podcast.
Indeed.
With Alistair McGrath. The man is an absolute ninja. We've recorded 8 podcasts in a sort of 3-hour sitting. So we've got 16 in the bag that are still to come. And I might even try and record some while I'm on maternity leave. Who knows?
Wow. So you focus on the main thing, which is being on maternity leave and enjoying that new baby. But you've been an absolute star, Ruth. It's been exciting to see the way you've thrown yourself into that new podcast. I genuinely love listening to it when I go running. If there's a new episode to play, I will download the C.S. Lewis podcast with I was about to say N.T. Wright. No, that's the other podcast.
That's the other podcast.
That's the other one with Alistair McGrath. All the best. I'm not left completely bereft because I do. We have someone special joining us, who I'm sure we'll introduce to the Unbelievable audience while you're away and into the future as well, who's going to be a new addition to the Unbelievable team as we are producing blogs and podcasts and resources out of our ears. So it'll be good to have someone in to take up where you've left off, Ruth. But for now, thank you so much. God bless you, Will, and the baby.
Thank you.
Yes, we will miss Ruth, but all the very best to her as this new chapter, exciting new chapter of her life unfolds. And I'm sure Ruth will be back before too long. Okay, that's all we've time for on today's show. Thanks for being with us today. Do look forward to your feedback on today's debate on the universe, and look forward to joining us again for next week as we continue our Summer of Science. Intelligent design in biology is what we'll be looking at next time. Dr. Günter Beckley is a German paleontologist who became convinced that the fossil record can't be explained by Darwinian evolution. He's now a strong advocate for intelligent design. He'll be debating that with computational biologist Joshua Swamidas, who advocates for reconciling evolution and creation. We'll be back same time next week. See you then.